Hi, my name is Robert Finley, and you're listening to The Block of Rock.
Hallo Leute, ich grüße euch heute noch einmal als Anhalter auf meinem American Road Trip. Alle Stammgäste meines Podcasts kennen ja bereits die Geschichte. Animiert von einem Gläschen meines Lieblings-Bourbon Maker's Mark kam ich auf den Geschmack, gemeinsam mit euch einen virtuellen Trip quer durch die USA zu machen, um nach den Wurzeln meiner musikalischen Helden zu buddeln. Wer den bisherigen Verlauf der Reise verpasst hat, der sollte sich noch einmal schnell die dazugehörige Trailer-Episode etwas weiter unten anhören. Vor allem, welche Rolle hier eine Flasche aus Kentucky, USA mit einem roten Wachssiegel spielt, die mich mit einem milden, bernsteinfarbenen, süßlichen Inhalt bei 45 Umdrehungen zu diesen handgemachten Geschichten inspiriert hat. Wir sind vor mittlerweile 6 Episoden in Chicago gestartet, waren zunächst bei Cheap Trick in Rockford, Illinois. Danach ging es über weite Teile der alten Route 66 nach St. Louis, Missouri, wo wir eine Menge Südstaaten-Feeling von Devin Allman und seiner Allman Betts Band bekommen haben. Anschließend ging es zur Bourbon-Distille nach Noretto, Kentucky, wo wir alles über die Herstellung von Maker's Mark erfahren haben. Und von dort aus weiter nach Edmonton zu John Fred Young vom Blackstone Cherry, der von einem Stadionbesuch eines Bundesligaspiels träumt. In den letzten Wochen machen wir dann noch einen längeren Stopover in Nashville, Tennessee, der aktuell sicherlich wichtigsten Musikstadt der USA, ach was, der Welt. Hier haben wir zunächst die beiden Lovell-Schwestern, besser bekannt als Larking Poe, getroffen und danach den König des Modern Blues, Joe Bonamassa, der uns auf eine Tasse Royal Tea in sein Studio einlud. Und heute? Schwingt euren Hintern auf den Beifahrersitz, es wird mit 500 Meilen ein strammer Ritt. Auf geht's! Wir lassen Nashville hinter uns und düsen mit unserem roten Mustang Cabrio etwas über 200 Meilen westwärts auf der Interstate 40 Richtung Memphis. Hier wollte ich eigentlich noch einen Zwischenstopp bei Elvis in Graceland und den legendären Sun Studios einlegen, aber die Zeit ist leider zu knapp, da unser heutiger Gesprächspartner bereits auf uns wartet. Alles geht halt nicht. Nach Memphis cruisen wir auf dem gleichen Highway 140 Meilen bis Little Rock in Arkansas, wo wir dann noch einmal genauso lang ganz entspannt über Land auf der Route 167 cruisen, bis wir endlich in Louisiana, dem Pelican State, angekommen sind. Die Website visittheusa.de erklärt uns hier Folgendes. Louisiana gehört zwar geografisch gesehen zu den amerikanischen Südstaaten, hat aber seine ganz eigene Geschichte. Heute präsentiert sich der Bundesstaat als perfekter kultureller Schmelztiegel mit einer einzigartigen Mischung aus afrikanischen, französischen, indianischen, frankokanadischen, haitianischen und europäischen Elementen. Der Bundesstaat wird im Osten durch den Mississippi River und im Süden durch den Golf von Mexiko begrenzt und war im Laufe der Jahrhunderte den unterschiedlichsten Einflüssen ausgesetzt. Im Südwesten Louisianas ist daraus die unverwechselbare Cajun-Kultur entstanden. Dann ist da natürlich auch New Orleans. Die berühmte Stadt ist reich an Geschichte und Charme und bietet eine Musik- und Gastroszene, die ihresgleichen sucht. Vom Mardi Gras, der dortigen Form des Karnevals, ganz zu schweigen. Und sie ist die Heimat meines Lieblingsteams aus der NFL, der New Orleans Saints. Des American Football Teams, bei dem Quarterback Drew Brees fast 20 Jahre zu einem der GOATs, Greatest of All Time, aufstieg, bevor er dieses Jahr seine erfolgreiche Karriere als Spieler beendete. Leider ohne Super Bowl Gewinn. In Louisiana gibt es landschaftliche Besonderheiten, wie die ausgedehnten, von unzähligen Vögeln bevölkerten Sümpfe oder die Outdoor-Ziele im Norden des Bundesstaats. Und genau da sind wir auch heute, in Bernice, Louisiana, einer 1500-Seelen-Gemeinde. Hier lebt Robert Finley. Der US Army Veteran war Zeit seines Lebens ein Entertainer und sensationeller Soulsänger. Aber erst als er vor ein paar Jahren sein Augenlicht verlor, wurde er, nach 6 Jahrzehnten harter Arbeit als Teilnehmer der TV-Show America's Got Talent, über Nacht zur Sensation und schaffte es sogar bis ins Halbfinale. Ich verlinke euch mal ein Video in den Shownotes, das müsst ihr gesehen haben. Seitdem lebt er den musikalischen Traum und gilt als The Biggest Living Soul Singer. Supported und produziert wird er von Dan Auerbach, dem Gitarristen der Black Keys, die gerade selbst mit Delta Cream ihre eigene Hommage an die Blues-Legenden von Mississippi veröffentlicht haben und sensationell auf Platz 3 der deutschen Albumcharts gelandet sind. Robert Finley ist eins von 8 Kindern und wurde 1953 in Winsboro, Louisiana geboren. 3 Alben hat er in den letzten 5 Jahren veröffentlicht. Das erste, Age Don't Mean a Thing, war sehr, sehr soul-lastig. Das zweite, Going Platinum, trug die Handschrift von Dan Auerbach und die Songs bei seinem neuen Album Sharecropper's Son inklusive des Titelsongs sind inspiriert von Finleys Kindheit. Roberts Vater war ein Farmpächter, ein Sharecropper, und weil er oft beim Baumwollpflücken helfen musste, konnte er nicht regelmäßig die Schule besuchen. Und so sagt der Sänger über sich selbst, in den Baumwollfeldern zu arbeiten war kein angenehmer Platz, aber ein Teil meines Lebens. Als Junge hat sich nie jemand dafür interessiert, was ich dachte oder sagte. Aber als ich mich dann in der Musik ausdrückte, hörten die Leute plötzlich zu. Mich hat dieser Mann irgendwie fasziniert. Er hat es ganz und gar nicht leicht gehabt, aber jetzt mit knapp 70 startet er nochmal richtig musikalisch durch. Macht euch daher auf eine Portion Gänsehaut gefasst. Mir ging dieses Gespräch wirklich sehr nahe. Ich blicke auf dem Bildschirm in ein einfaches amerikanisches Wohnzimmer, in dem mich Roberts Tochter begrüßt und den Computer einstellt. Robert ist am grünen Star erkrankt, besser auch bekannt als Glaukom, und hat nur noch sehr wenig Sehkraft. Ich habe jedoch den Eindruck, dass er mit seinen Ohren sehen kann, als er sich mit seinem aus den Videos bekannten Farmerhut auf den Stuhl vor seinen Rechner setzt und mich gut gelaunt begrüßt.
How you doing, man? Thanks for having me. I'm doing good.
Zunächst wollte ich mal wissen, was für ihn das Besondere an seiner Heimat Louisiana ist. Ich bin jetzt weit gereist und wollte mal eine kurze Einführung.
Well, I've been here all my life. I've traveled around, but I always wind up back here. So I guess the greatest thing about it is there's no place like home. That's my roots. I don't know. I've tried other places, but I live in a small town. So everybody knows everybody, and it's kind of like a safe place. I feel comfortable enough where I can fall asleep in the yard and not be worried about anything going down or anybody bothering anything. So, everybody in town pretty much knows me. So it's kind of like a family because I don't think there's anybody here that I don't know unless they just came into town or something. So that's an advantage, especially when I was doing carpentry work because the customers would always do the recommending. And so I didn't have to do any promotion or anything. I was just word of mouth. People see the work and they want to know who did it, and then they'll reach out to me to do theirs. So I had quite a waiting list. I never ran out of work because I guess the fact that I took time with that extra mile to make sure everything was right.
Wie hat denn in den früheren Jahren seine Leidenschaft für die Musik entdeckt, wollte ich wissen.
Well, I always loved the music. In England, we didn't have TVs, but it would play on the radio. My dad sung in quartets group, so I always would sit on the front row and watch all of the musicians' hands. And even when I got old enough to sing in a choir, I always sit right by the piano player and just watch their hands. And so the passion for music, I guess, been there ever since I've been old enough to remember. But I bought my first guitar when I was 10, and I had played with a friend of mine's guitar before then, but I actually got the first one of my own at the age of 10. And ever since then, I very seldom was seen without one. I used to have one in the car somewhere in the back, behind the seat. It's just a habit. Don't go nowhere without a guitar. You never know when there was going to be an opportunity. So when you got people that everybody asks me, the first thing they ask me when they see me, where's the guitar? Because it's not normal for me to show up and don't have a guitar. Even if I don't pull it out, I always have it.
Robert hat in der US Army gedient und davon auch eine ganze Zeit in Deutschland gelebt. Unter anderem war er Helikoptertechniker. Welche Erinnerungen hat er an die Zeit? Und hat er während seines Dienstes auch Musik gemacht?
Oh yeah, yeah, uh-huh. I joined. I did the first thing in, as a matter of fact, the first night I spent, first day I spent in Germany. I got there on Friday and I got a chance to play that Saturday because the guy that was supposed to have been playing had just got out of the military. So I got a chance to meet all the big brass and the commanders and stuff because I played for company picnic. So I kind of saved the picnic. And the guy just saw me playing and he came to me and told me that they needed somebody to play. And I was like, I don't know anything of y'all music or nothing. They was like, no, just play what you're playing and we're going to follow you. So that was what I actually did the first time I was there. Got a chance to play for them, the whole battalion at one time. So I got to meet everybody at one time, a big company picnic. I was in Hillesheim, Germany. Not too far from Frankfurt, because we used to jump on the train and go out in Frankfurt. So, and then we had a few clubs in Frankfurt that we would get to play at every now and then. So the music had opened a lot of doors, a lot of opportunity. Basically, everything that really good came from the music, because even if they can't understand the language, some kind of way that people can communicate through the music. They just love the music. And I saw my daughter was showing me a lot of people who were translating the words. They did it in French and in Spain. They were taking it was my voice, but the screen was showing the words, translating the words in their language. So I thought that was pretty neat.
Nachdem er vom Armeedienst zurück nach Louisiana kam, arbeitete er als Zimmermann in seinem Ort weiter.
I was doing the carpentry because that's what my dad did, and so I knew that if I wanted that you'd be your own boss. You make your own, your own wages to work. You make your own hours. So it was independence. You didn't have to punch no clock. Didn't have to answer to anybody. Just satisfy the customer that you're working for. So yeah, other than the military, I never had really held any other type of job. I tried it and I never was satisfied with it. So I just went back to doing what I knew I could be in control of, and that was doing a carpentry.
Ich hatte über Robert gelesen, dass er zwar seine physische Sehkraft verloren, aber dafür mit der Musik seine wahre Bestimmung entdeckt hat. Wie hat er es denn als blinder Zimmermann aus einer US-Kleinstadt geschafft, einen Plattendeal zu bekommen?
No, I lose my sight to where I couldn't read tape measure well enough to to make an accurate cut. So then that's when I was just having started playing my music more. I got into the music as a way of escaping from the. I really was just having fun, and people started to tipping. They started to doing more and more. Everybody was the tips were good, and so I was like, I'll play a little longer. I think I'll play a little longer. And then a guy from a Music Maker Relief Foundation came through, and name was Tim Duffy, and he was asked me would I be interested in traveling and doing that around the world. And I was like, yeah, I ain't got nothing. I wasn't able to do anything else. But I didn't really think he was going to call or anything, because people always say things when they're out drinking, and then they don't never get around to, you never hear from them again. So I just assumed we wasn't going to do anything else. But in about a week, he called me. I had one of the guys call me. They wanted to come to my hometown, come to Bernice where I was staying. But I felt like it'd be better if I went to them, because I needed to know that it was legit and wasn't just a scam, to get the my music and stuff. And so that's when I went out there to see them. They was in Carolina, in North Carolina. So I told them if they bought me a round trip plane ticket, I would come. And so they did. I had it to where all I had to do was go to the airport and show my ID, and they had covered the round trip. So I actually went and recorded with them, and then they sent it around to different publishers, and Fat Possum Records did the first album. The first album was Age Don't Mean a Thing, which was very much telling the story too, because a lot of people give up at a certain age, or people think, you get over 60 years old, you're headed downhill. And I'm like, that's when life began, because you got the experience, you got the know-how, and then you should be where you shouldn't have to work around the clock anyway. And so when I said age don't mean a thing, the title kind of wrong to, a lot of people saying, well, don't give up at that age, Like everybody like to retire at 65, and I'm saying, let's come alive at 65.
Einen großen Anteil an Roberts Entwicklung hat der bereits angesprochene Dan Orbeck, der Roberts bei dem letzten Album in sein Easy Eye Sound Studio in Nashville produziert hat. Wie kam es denn zu dieser Connection?
Yeah, actually, the guy from Fat Possum Records introduced me to Dan, because Dan used to be under the Fat Possum label before he got his own. And they were doing a book called Murder Banner, and they were looking for a voice to sing four songs that was on the album. And we had 4 days to do it. And I actually did all four songs the first day. So we had three more days of studio time that we wasn't doing anything. So Dan had a bunch of songs that they had already written, and he asked me would I be interested in singing an album off of the song. So we actually did about 15 songs, and we put 10 of them on the album. And so we were ready for the next, you know, we talked about it when we made that deal that the next album I would be doing most of the writing, because I didn't write anything on the first album. All of the songs was, you know, he already had. And so the ones that he picked to put on, the ones in the book was four songs. And then we had did, I think, about 11 more. And we just decided to release that album. Now, the next album, that was the album Going Platinum. And so that was the first one I did with Dan Umba. And I didn't know anything about him. I had never heard of it. I was told, I was in Germany when I got the call that somebody wanted me to do the record. And I didn't have any idea what, you know, what I was getting into until I got there. And that's when I found out that who Dan Auerbach really was, when I looked up on the shelf and saw all those trophies. I saw about 7 Grammys sitting up on, you know. And then I called my daughter and I told her the guy's name and stuff. And she went online and pulled it up, and she called me back that night and said, "Dad, you in there with some real rock stars. You know, these are people of you. You know, you're gonna make it or break it right there. It's an opportunity of a lifetime." Which, so we nailed it. We did the album within those 3 days that we had left, and we still had plenty of time left, because I couldn't read it, but Dan would tell me. I would listen to the music, and then he would tell me in my ear what the next, you know, line was. And it was amazing that, you know, as soon as he tell me, I just would holler it out, and I kind of use my own style of doing it. And, you know, he said, "I just want you to be yourself. You know, don't try to sound like me. Sound like yourself." So that was a great opportunity for those guys. It took patience, you know, dealing with a blind man not being able to read the sheets and read the, you know, the music or the lyrics. So, but he, you know, it was like, "You can do this. I know you can do it." So, you know, when other people got a lot of confidence in you, it makes you, it brings out the best in you when you're around all these different people that know, you know what I'm saying? When you get guys that been writing all their lives and been doing, like, you know, Pat Gone, Bobby Woods, these guys, they wrote for Elvis Presley, Aretha Franklin, they done wrote for everybody. And when you get people like that to give you a high compliment, that's rewarding, because you know that they've seen it all, they've done it all, and for them to say, to be amazed and to give you that high of a praise on it, I thought it was great. So that just boosted my ego and made me want to try harder, you know, to do more.
Roberts Stimme ist auf allen drei Alben extrem variabel. Er scheint die Tonlagen spielerisch einzusetzen. Mal tief brummend, dann wieder hoch wie ein Goldkehlchen. Hört euch dazu mal den Song Holy Wine an. Wie hat er denn gemerkt, dass er diese Gabe hat?
The falsetto was I was just really just playing. We had finished the album and we had already did the song Holy Wine, and we were playing it back and listening to it. And I started to doing it in a falsetto, and that's when Dan said, "Man, can you do the whole song like that?" And I was like, "I don't know. I'll say I've never tried it. I'll just try it." So then we did it and played it back, and people were saying, "How is he?" And I didn't really think that much about it. I was just having fun, but everybody was so amazed that I had such a wide range that I could, you know, could go from bass to falsetto without even thinking about it. Just what it. So sometimes Dan would point up and he'd point down, you know, and I would know that I needed to use the high pitch. And he liked it to mix it on some of the songs to do both. And I always loved it. One of my favorites, you know, I always loved the Al Green style of singing. So I got a chance to do it all. Whatever I wanted to do, they just give me an open run. Nobody put no demands on me. They were just like, "Just be yourself and let's have some fun."
Ich wollte noch wissen, wie das neue Album entstanden ist. Auch, weil Dan Auerbach gerade noch mit anderen Veröffentlichungen beschäftigt war und auch seine eigene Band, The Black Keys, gerade ein eigenes Blues-Album veröffentlicht hat.
So the new album, we did write some of the songs. Me and Bobby Woods, Pat Gorn, and Dan. I had one writing session with Bobby Woods, and then I had one writing session with Pat Gorn and Dan. So we did them on a separate day. And so I had one day with this co-writer and the next day with that one. But the music, that was the song that we wrote. But the songs like Sharecropper Son, the soundtrack, and Country Boy and Country Child, those songs were not written. The band was playing, and they was... It was sounding good, and I walked in the room, and Dan said, sing something to it. And I didn't have time to write anything, so I just started talking about my upbringing and my childhood. And that's why it was no need to write it, because I was just telling my you know, reminiscing back to the early days, to where we, and all that stuff is actually true on Sharecropper Son. There was no makeup or no ad lib, and you know, everything was just like it was. And I have 7 siblings that when I played it for them, and they were all in agreement, that's really the way it was, you know. And I didn't want to say something that would come back and haunt me later. So I had to keep it as real as I could remember. And so they wanted to, once they heard it, they were all saying, yo, this is act, this is the way it was, this is it. So, and because I wanted their approval before I actually put it out there. But they were glad that I told it. But all of the older people that I've talked to that's heard the album, it brings back memories, not always good memories, but it's history to the young people because it's new to them, and it's memories to the older. So I think that the fact that kids and grandkids and grandpa and they all can sit down and listen to the same record and everybody enjoy it, that's the good part about it, you know, because you're filling the generation gap. And for Dan Arbach is probably 30-something years younger than I am, because he was in his 30s when we met, and I was in my 60s. So, but to say that with a 30-year gap, and then we clicked, I guess we met each other halfway. But I would say I was just what he was looking for, and he was just what I was looking for. And then when I got the opportunity, we just nailed it. It just came together. It didn't seem like work, but you know, it was 10 hours and 12 hours, you know, a days. We normally would be in the studio from 10 in the morning until 10 at night. And nobody left. Nobody went outside. I mean, you know, nobody left. Everything was ordered in. The food was ordered in. Drinks was ordered in. Because everybody was strictly trying to meet the time, you know, get as much recorded as we could in that little time. And when you got all these great musicians playing around you, you know, when you in, how you say, when you in with the best, it brings out the best in you. So Dan had gotten some of the greatest musicians that were still alive. I won't say that ever. But the ones that had retired and were no longer, had made their living with music, and they getting royalties from all these different record labels. But he got all these guys to come out of retirement and come back together. So it didn't matter. He just wanted the best he could find. And he got a pretty good crew now because he's got a lot. But they all came out of retirement for the studio. And after we did that album, we had so much fun doing the album. They decided to go on the road again, and everybody was excited because they hadn't been out on the road in so long. And I was excited because they chose me to come out of retirement with. And at the age of 63, I was the new kid on the block. I was the youngest thing in the room besides Dan Arbach.
Sharecropper Son ist ein sehr persönliches Album und führt uns knapp 60 Jahre zurück auf die Baumwollfelder von Louisiana. Wie war seine Kindheit und welchen Einfluss hatte sie auf das Songwriting für dieses Album?
I'm not proud of my childhood, because it was, you know, it was a rough childhood. But at the same time, if I had not experienced it, then I wouldn't be talking about it today, you know. And so, yeah, it's real, it's history. And young people don't read no books anymore. You know, if they want to know something, they just ask Siri. They pick up their phone, they ask Siri. And so writing a book is okay, because now we have talking books and everything else. But the song, if you put the music to it with some good music, and then people listen to what you have to say, as long as the music is good. Because nowadays, you really don't have to say anything. Just have some good music. And half the time, they don't know what they... what the artist is talking about. They're just jamming to the beat. But it's important that the artist tells a story, make, you know, what he said need to make sense, and it need to be like a reading a short novel when you listen to a song. At the end of the song, you should be able to go away with the moral of the story or something.
Ihr solltet euch unbedingt selbst mal ein Bild von Roberts Musik machen. Es ist ein entspannter Mix aus Gospel, Blues, Soul und Rock'n'Roll. Am Ende dieser Podcast-Episode gebe ich euch noch einen Tipp, wo ihr es hören könnt auf meiner Playlist. Aber wer sind seine großen Einflüsse?
Well, I loved it. I loved it, Al Green. I loved it, the style of Joe Simon, and Tyrone Davis. All these guys had a part in it, because I guess I kind of do a little bit of a style from each person, and so it's kind of like the music is more or less like a gumbo. You get a little bit of soul, you get a little bit of rock, you get a little bit of blues, you know. That's the purpose for that. Well, that's the intention, is that whoever listened to the album, it's got to be something on there that, you know, that they really like. And some people call it blues, and some people label it from gospel to blues to rock. But I just call it the truth. And so we came up with the name of the country soul. So we started to do, because we do have a country and western style and the, you know, the soul singing style. But yeah, I would say it would be an Al Green. Now, my blues was always B.B. King. And that was what I was striving for when I played the guitar, was to find that style. And so I really trained myself how to change and all the breaks from the blues by listening to, you know, to B.B. King and Little Richard, Ray Charles. All these guys had their own style, as you would say. And I kind of liked them all. So I wind up doing, when I was doing covers, I would sing their different ones. So, and so I guess when I did get a chance to do some recording, I wanted to be more than one style of music, because I wanted to be able to reach a wider and broader audience. And I think I did. I got the attention of the young generation, of the young people. So that was a great thing. And then, like I said, the older people, I took them down memory lane. And they, you know, so they love it for the fact that it's, you know, it's a true story. And the young people, they just love it because it's different.
Das ganze Album hört sich sehr organisch an. Ist auch eine Live-Umsetzung nach der Pandemie geplant?
Right now, we're not doing any traveling. There's not a lot of shows going on. The only thing we've really been able to nail down on my upcoming tours is festivals, you know, where we are outside. And I'm not in the push to be the first to get back out there, because I want to make sure, I don't want to be caused of, you know, people getting sick or coming, you know, to try to get to see Robert Finley. So I'm patient. I can wait until the country's safe to move around. But it's like being on the stall, though, with me, you know, the horse in the stall, and, you know, if they ever open this gate, you know what I'm saying? I'll be ready to run. I'll be ready to travel. Because, like you say, I even love the traveling part, because on the plane, I mean, sometimes once we got on an airplane, and one of the pilots knew about it. I mean, he had seen the show, and so they actually played the music through the system on the plane. I thought that was the weirdest thing. I've never had experienced that before. So now you got 500 people on the plane. Everybody wants to talk to you before, you know, you miss the next plane, trying to, you know. And we stop at the airport. I mean, we at the airport and waiting there. Sometimes I would just, I'd get bored if I had a long wait. I'll just whoop out my guitar and start playing there in the tournament. And then next thing you know, somebody will start tipping. Then you know, somebody wants some merch, they want to buy it. And that's the whole idea, is to sell records wherever you're at, you know. And so Dan says he never deal with nobody that does that. He never deal with nobody that does that. Everywhere they stop, they got to sell something. We go in a restaurant, if they're playing music, I'm constantly trying to get them to play my music while we eat, you know. So it was so funny when they came out for lunch. Everybody came out to eat, come down to eat supper, and then they was amazed. How do you pull that off? off? How do you get that to happen? I mean, and I just go to the front desk in the hotel and give it to the clerk and tell them what I want to do. They pretty much would let me do whatever I wanted to do. So, but yeah, it was just a lot of fun to be doing, you know, because like I said, people listening at the airport, they're not expecting to get a concert. You know, they're waiting on the plane. And so everybody would stay as long as they could, and then they go catch the next plane. But yeah, that was fun. I love to just deal with the public here, because I always, like I said, I've always had my own construction company, so I always made my living off general public. And so that, I guess that's where it comes, makes it so easy for me to get along with people, because I was always in somebody's house.
Oh, gibt's auch vielleicht Pläne für eine Europatour?
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, because my booking agent is already working on my European tour. I got publicity. This guy that does all the publicity is that's really the reason why I'm talking with you guys, trying to get the word out that so when we come, people be already expecting and they'll already know who we are.
Ich würde mich sehr freuen, wenn das im kommenden Jahr wirklich klappt. Danke an Robert für dieses doch sehr emotionale Gespräch.
Hey, thank you, man. You take care too. Bye-bye.
Wenn ihr jetzt auch noch mehr Lust bekommen habt, in die Songs von Robert Filney reinzuhören, dann klickt doch mal auf meine Playlist des American Road Trip. Das Ganze gibt es auf Spotify. Ihr findet den Link dazu in den Shownotes. Das ist die Beschreibung zu dieser Episode bei dem Portal, über die ihr diese Geschichte gerade gehört. Für heute sind wir dann aber auch schon wieder durch. Aber schon nächste Woche geht es weiter quer durch die USA, wo ich in Austin, Texas einen alten Freund treffen werde, der aus einem ganz anderen musikalischen Universum stammt. Lasst euch mal überraschen und hört wieder rein. Ich gönne mir jetzt noch einen Drink. Prost, auch auf euch. Und danke, dass ihr wieder mitgefahren seid.